Be here at the College of William & Mary School of Law, and it's my pleasure tonight to be the moderator for this panel discussion. And I think all those in the audience have been introduced to our panelists, but I'm not sure for purposes of posterity in our tape that everyone knows who everyone here is. So let me just briefly mention who these folks are. Ann Beeson is staff counsel with the ACLU, National Legal Department out of New York. Deidre Mulligan, next to her, is staff counsel of the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington. Jonathan Zittrain is the executive director of the Beckman Center at the Harvard Law School. And next to him is Bruce Taylor, who is president and chief counsel of the National Center for Children and Families. And finally, Bruce Watson, who is president of the organization Enough is Enough. And the format tonight, I think, will be interesting and kind of fun for everyone. I've asked each of my colleagues to spend about 10 minutes or so talking about some issues that they see in connection with internet problems and protection of children and some of the statutory approaches that have been taken. And we'll cover everyone. That should take us about 45 or 50 minutes. And then at the end of that period, I'm going to open it up to questions from the audience, and members of the audience can certainly direct a question to any one member of the panel, but then I'm going to ask anyone else on that panel if they'd like to respond as well. In terms of some of the specific issues that I suspect we'll be hearing about tonight, much of this begins, I think, with the Supreme Court's decision just a few years ago dealing with the Communications Decency Act. The Supreme Court struck that down, as I suspect most of you recall, as violative of the First Amendment. Congress then went back to work and passed the Child Online Protection Act, passed very recently, trying to narrow the focus a bit, particularly with respect to commercial use of the Internet and minors. And litigation then was brought by, among others, some of our panelists here, challenging that, too, under the First Amendment. Well, the jury, so to speak, is still out on that, though the first blow has gone to the challengers, with Judge Reed in Philadelphia striking down the statute, and as I understand it, the matter is now on appeal. So the stage is set, I think, for continued litigation specifically with respect to the statute, and also, of course, the broader issues that we deal with on a regular basis in this area. So without any further ado, I turn it over to Ann Beeson. Ann, if you would, share some thoughts with us.
Sure. It was a very interesting experience to participate in the earlier moot court and really sort of solidified the comments I was planning to make to the panel anyway, which we have now at the ACLU challenged five different state attempts to make it a crime to communicate certain categories of material on the internet. And we have succeeded so far in having all five struck down. And I'm here to tell you something, and this, in particular since the audience is primarily law students, I think this is a very important message, that it is my very firm belief that our wins have had nothing to do with First Amendment law or any of the theoretical issues that we've all discussed or that were the focus of the presentations during the moot court, and everything to do with the facts. And a lot of times, and I know obviously it's very important for all of us to be very familiar with First Amendment jurisprudence and all of the intricacies of all of the case law, none of that would matter if there were not the speech that there is on the internet and if we had not focused primarily on that speech in our argument and focused primarily on the facts about the internet as a speech-enhancing medium. And to relate back to the problem, if we had had Flint Hefner, this hypothetical Flint Hefner, as our only client in any of these cases, including the first ACLU versus Reno, and the second, in my opinion, it wouldn't matter how much law was on our side. Courts would find a way to uphold these statutes. They would do it. They would have, you know, used the broadcast analogy. They would have done whatever they had to do to uphold the statute. Fortunately, Flint Hefner and his friends are not the only speakers on the internet. There are many, many millions of speakers on the internet which communicate an incredibly broad array of types of speech, some of which have to do with sexual topics, and much of which has much value for adults, even though many people would find it to be harmful to children. I want to focus just a little bit on the actual evidence that we submitted in the most recent case in Philadelphia, just to give you a sense of how important that is in convincing judges in these cases to come to the right conclusion. There's a lot of talk often from our adversaries in particular about the hand-picked ACLU federal judiciary and why it is that we keep running these cases. And the funny thing is, if you look at the judges, they're all, in fact, with the exception, I think, of, you know, it's very hard to count even, of all the judges that have listened to any to our cases, there's maybe one or two that were appointed by the Democratic presidents. Judge Reed in Philadelphia was a Reagan-appointed judge. And again, it just goes to show that it isn't politics, it's speech that's winning these cases. There are 36.7 million unique host computers on the Internet, or there were as of July 1998. There are 70 million people in the United States alone using the medium. There's no doubt that the medium has become a very easy and inexpensive way for speakers of all types to reach a large audience, potentially millions. The startup and operating costs are so low that there are many, many people who have begun to earn their living and begun to earn profits by communicating free information on the Internet. Some of our clients in the case and some of the ones that testified I want to tell you about. Mitch Tepper is about to receive his PhD in psychology from Carnegie Mellon. He runs a site on the Internet that he set up called the Sexual Health Network. And it is a site that provides very explicit sexual advice targeted to the disabled on how they can experience sexual pleasure. It's not a safe sex site. It's not about how to protect yourself or from AIDS, anything like that. It's a site on how to enjoy sex, and it could actually have a lot of meaning for people who aren't disabled as well. So there's not a lot of argument that has some other educational value that makes it different than other than sexually explicit information for people who aren't disabled. It just happens to be targeted to a disabled audience. He testified about how important this information is for his audience on the Internet, many of whom would not have would never ask their doctor about for advice like this. This medium has basically given them an opportunity to find information that they could find almost nowhere else, and to do so anonymously. And he testified that if he were required to set up an age verification system on his site, he is certain that he would lose 99% of his audience. Tom Riley is the CEO of Planet Out, which is a very large gay and lesbian content provider on the Internet. Planet Out derives its revenue almost exclusively from advertising online. And include they have 350,000 unique visitors per month. These numbers, again, are very important. We're not talking about just a few speakers, for example, like in the dial-up porn case, calling in to phone sex services. We're talking about 350,000 visitors looking at some of this stuff per month. And those kind of facts are just crucial when the judge, is thinking, okay, how much potential speech is going to be impacted by this. 100,000 separate web pages just on Planet Out alone, okay? There are 45 different message boards. Literally tens of thousands of people post and read messages on these boards every day. And that was a big focus of the testimony as well, that there's much web-based chat and discussion online, all of which would have to be censored entirely if there were a risk that a minor could access it. In other words, it's not possible to place any kind of age verification screen within that kind of web-based discussion forum except for at the entrance to the forum, so that even with respect to messages that are being posted that aren't harmful to minors, all of the adults, all of the users would have to put in their credit cards first. David Talbot, the CEO of Salon Magazine, a very popular online magazine, with diverse content, but some adult content. I mean, they have a regular column by Susie Bright called Sexpert Opinion. It was very hard for the government to stand up and try to say that the information in Susie Bright's Sexpert Opinion column, had value for minors. It was clear that this was covered speech. The judge knew it when we presented the evidence in the courtroom. People were nervous. People were embarrassed. It's explicit information, but it's information that, even a conservative judge is going to believe that adults have the right to access. And all of this information is being provided on the Internet for free, and all of it would be greatly inhibited if COPPA were to go into effect. The other category of facts that proved crucial to the holding were that the primary business model on the web today is providing free content, not selling things, providing free content. People are making a profit two ways, both by providing a whole bunch of free content, so that then by the end of the looking at all the free content, you might at some point or another, maybe not first visit, buy something on the site, for example, the Amazon.com model. Or again, the advertising model, which turns out is in fact the primary model. Many businesses are attempting to make a profit, not a lot of them are making a profit yet, it turns out, including Amazon.com. By providing free content and getting revenue through advertisers. And their advertisers, the evidence showed, depend on number of visitors in order to guarantee the contract. Just like with print or TV, you know, Salon Magazine says, I guarantee that 100,000 visitors are going to see the ad on this page. And unless you can guarantee, say the advertiser is Microsoft, unless Microsoft can know for sure that they're going to get 100,000 visitors, they won't give them the money for the ad. And the evidence showed that if you set up any kind of age verification screen, the numbers would plummet so much that the advertisers would go away. The whole business model might fail on the web. Third, the evidence showed that users would be deterred greatly by registration. Any registration, not even a credit card. Donna Hoffman, Professor Hoffman from Vanderbilt University, has done quite a lot of studies, and she gave a lot of expert testimony relying on these studies that showed that up to 75% of users will not provide any kind of personal identification in order to obtain access to free content on the web. So again, I just want to continue to reiterate that we can have all the law in the world. You've got to know, to win these kinds of cases, you've got to know the facts. You've got to emphasize that speech is the issue, not economics. And in fact, to close, I just want to, I know some of you may have read Judge Reed's recent opinion, but he said this quite eloquently, actually. And it again comes down to why we win the case, why I think we're winning these cases and not losing them. He wrote, First Amendment jurisprudence indicates that the relevant inquiry is determining the burden imposed on the protected speech regulated by COPA, not the pressure placed on the pocketbooks or the bottom lines of the plaintiffs or of other website operators and content providers not before the court. Strict scrutiny is required not because of the risk of driving certain commercial websites out of business, but the risk of driving this particular type of protected speech from the marketplace of ideas. His focus in ruling our favor was on the speech, and this speech, Mitch Tepper, and Planet Out, you know, and the Sexual Health Network and Salon Magazine, not on the pornography sites that are already requiring credit card verification on the web. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Ann. We turn now to Bruce Watson. Bruce?
Thank you. I'd like to start by taking a couple of minutes to illustrate the problem. Since if there isn't actually a problem, then there's no point in us agonizing over the solution. And the way I'd like to illustrate the problem is by asking you to imagine what would it be like if the physical world worked the same way as cyberspace does. Imagine, you take your 10-year-old daughter or your 10-year-old sister to the shopping mall, and in front of it, on the sidewalk, are full-size hardcore pictures advertising a live sex show. And that's right beside Toys R Us. Or you take your 11-year-old son or brother, their school, let's say the school in the library stocks Hustler or Deep Throat, and the school says it's up to the parents to keep them from the kids. Or your 12-year-old daughter or sister gets an envelope in the mail claiming to contain information about a free vacation, and inside she finds a dozen photographs of teen sex. I don't give these examples to shock. I give them because the real world doesn't work this way, but unfortunately at this point the internet does. Now, COPA doesn't address all of these problems, but it does address the first one. Why in the world should commercial porn operators be allowed to put free samples of their materials where kids can trip over them? Pornography, unfortunately, is blindingly easy to encounter on the internet. Two separate studies have now estimated the total revenue of adult sites at approaching $1 billion. It didn't get this big by being hard to find. It can be found intentionally or unintentionally. The unintentional ones are the ones that are particularly of a concern when you're dealing with kids. Many people are familiar with the difference between the whitehouse.gov site, which is the official White House site. Whitehouse.com is a porn site, which takes you straight into it. An increasing problem is the misuse of brand names. Earlier, I was going to say this week, it was last week, a study by the online research company Cyvalence estimated that 25% of pornography sites use popular brand names to lure customers. And they do this by putting the brand names in the search engine magnets, which are the hidden or the visible text and meta tags. And the result is that seemingly innocuous search terms lead to porn sites. Their study of 19,000 porn sites found that the top 10 misused brand names included child-oriented brands like Disney, Barbie, and Nintendo. And in the case that was used earlier on this evening, the example was given of a site, Bambi.com. Well, until recently, Bambi.com was a porn site. If you go to visit Mulan.com, you find the site for the Disney film. If you apply the same logic and go to Bambi.com, until very recently, you were straight into a hardcore site. One of the more egregious ones to me is Nintendo's Pokemon. Can I have a show of hands as to who knows what Pokemon is? Less than half. That's typical. If I'd asked for a show of hands amongst people aged 15 or less, you'd have got 100%. If you ask for people aged 40 above, nobody knows. It's the latest Nintendo craze. We were told about this by somebody who contacted us. What's Nintendo? We were told about this situation recently by somebody who contacted us. We tested it ourselves. When we put in Pokemon pictures into one of the standard search engines, the first link was to a porn site. There was no evidence, no indication in the description that it would be a porn site. When you went there, the first screen was hardcore pornography, and when you were in, you couldn't get out. It was impossible to hit the back button. They had some Java programming that just took you to another part of the site. And you were taking in a loop through different parts of the site, getting clear images of vaginal, oral, and anal sex. Apologize for being so explicit, but that's what kids are finding. For most people to get out of that site, unless you have fairly advanced knowledge, you basically have to shut the computer off. It's the only way to get away. Who are these people targeting? And let's also be realistic about intentional access. That I'm sure everybody knows if you actually go looking for pornography, you can't miss it on the internet. But curiosity in children and teenagers is natural and healthy, which is exactly why, as a society, we've never made pornography available to them, because that's not where we want kids to learn sexual role models and relationships. So to summarize, it's there, it's big time, and it's easy to encounter. This isn't what we let kids do in the physical world or let people do to them. So where does that take us? I believe it takes us to the need to apply the standards of the physical world into the cyber world. Not new standards, let's just maintain our existing standards in the cyber world. Now, a good starting point that COPA has addressed is the free samples, because all of the foreign sites have free samples. COPA simply requires the same age verification to access commercial foreign sites as is now required for telephone dial-up porn. Now, COPA has learned from the Communications Decency Act. The CDA was difficult to apply since it covered all of commercial websites, amateur news groups, chat rooms, email, anything. COPA deals with websites only. The CDA penalties would have been heavy if it had ever been applied to amateurs. COPA applies to commercial sites only. CDA implied, but didn't actually state in the language of the statute, a redeeming value test. COPA specifically excludes material with serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value for minors. The main difference between the two is that the CDA treated the internet like TV. It applied the broadcast standard of indecency to define the restriction. COPA treats the internet like books and magazines by applying the print standard of harmful to minors. But lo and behold, what we now find is that the opponents of COPA and the people who oppose our CDA are now raising the hurdle. If we read the ACLU publication Fahrenheit 451.2, which came out immediately after the CDA decision, they said, repeatedly, the Supreme Court declared that the internet deserves the same high level of speech protection afforded to books and other printed matter. By the time of censorship in a box 1 year later, they said, the court declared the internet to be a free speech zone deserving at least as much protection as books, newspapers, and magazines. And in fact, what we're seeing now that we have COPA, which does apply the print standard, which 2 years ago we were told was what they wanted, suddenly the print standard has become too vague, because in effect, just about anything might be considered harmful to minors by someone somewhere. All of the arguments about the difficulty of applying it, and what about this site and this site and this site, are based on the same basic premise, that nobody really knows what harmful to minors means. Well, harmful to minors is a defined legal term. The congressional record for COPA noted that cases such as Erosnik in 1975 and PICO in 1982 prevent the traditional harmful to minors test being extended to materials that merely contain nudity or sexual information, regardless of how controversial they may be for their political or sexual viewpoints. There is minimal evidence that the sorts of borderline cases that we're being presented with are ever successfully prosecuted under the print harmful to minor standard anywhere in the country. Now, is this because the print harmful to minor standard is in fact so variable by different communities? Well, actually, already people are applying it nationally. Magazines like Penthouse deal with this question every month. They're available right across the country in most communities, and every month they have to decide, they have a meeting to decide whether the material stacks up against the contemporary standards in the communities across the country. And judging from their financial success, they don't find it an impossible task. And meanwhile, magazines like Cosmopolitan obviously know that they're not harmful to minors, even though their cover stories on sex techniques are not that dissimilar from the co-plaintiffs that have been described on the COPA case. So the issue is how to make our existing standards work in cyberspace. Well, is it that, or are some groups trying to change the standard? And I think I have to mention this. You have to understand what the ACLU's policy is on obscenity, pornography, and indecency. And I have the greatest respect for Anne's earnestness in what she is doing. But the policy of our organization is, quote, that all limitations of expression on the ground of obscenity, pornography, or indecency are unconstitutional. And in just in case that wasn't sufficiently clear, it goes on, policy 4B, to explain that they believe laws which punish the distribution or exposure of such material to minors violate the First Amendment. Similarly, if you look at the record of the Electronic Freedom Foundation, who opposed both the CDA and the COPA, their founder, John Perry Barlow, is on record in various contexts saying he believes there should be no rule of law in cyberspace. So we have to recognize, as we keep hearing about these practical difficulties, that there is no law to keep pornography from minors on the internet which will ever be blessed by certain of its opponents, because by formal policy they disagree with the basic objective. So in conclusion, I would suggest that much of the opposition is the counsel of despair, basically saying the problem is too complicated to be solved. Well, please, if we can create the problem, we can create the solution. I happen to believe that we can protect both the First Amendment and kids. I believe that COPA does this by taking a focused approach to a specific problem and addressing it with the very well-established concept of material harmful to minors. The First Amendment will not fall in ruins if we continue our time-honored practice of putting the burden on pornographers to keep their wares away from kids.
Thank you, Bruce. We turn now to Deidre Mulligan. Deidre?
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here. I'm going to start from a slightly different place and tell you a little bit about the Center for Democracy and Technology. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the ACLU, and probably very few of you have heard of CDT. We're a small nonprofit in Washington, D.C., and we focus much more on the legislative process and the policy process than we do on litigation, although we were one of the organizers, along with the ACLU. There were actually two suits that were joined in the original Communications Decency Act litigation. And as Anne said, the facts have been incredibly important, but I think the other point that she raised is possibly even more important, and it's certainly even more important in the legislative process, and that is the breadth of people who are concerned about this issue. It is not just the ACLU or the Electronic Frontier Foundation. If you look at the plaintiffs in the original Communications Decency Act, or if you look at some of the amicus briefs that we submitted in the pending COPA litigation, I just want to give you a sense of the folks who don't believe that this statute is narrowly tailored. I think you'll see that many people who really, I don't think, would fit into the commercial pornographers or the hardcore pornographers box. They range from the Association of American Publishers, the American Society of Newspaper Editors, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, the commercial internet exchange, people who don't have any content at all but merely move information, the Freedom to Read Foundation of the American Library Association, the Magazine Publishers of America, the National Association of Recording Merchandisers, the Society of Professional Journalists. Just to give you a sense that these are folks who are very, very concerned about how we deal with speech in this medium. They're probably not folks who would necessarily be in court if this was only about commercial pornographers' ability to speak on the net in an unimpeded way. And rather than kind of talk about the pending litigation, which I think you've probably gotten kind of both sides of that issue, I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened on the Hill to bring us to where we are. After the CDA was struck down, Congress isn't likely to be told by the court that they got something wrong. And as certainly those of you who read the CDA decision, HLUV in their decision, now there was a roadmap that was set out that gave the court, that gave Congress some sense of where they might tread a little bit more successfully, and so they certainly did try to do that. The bill that passed in October, like the CDA, has a very thin legislative history and a very thin record of hearings. And so Van said, you know, the facts have become very, very important in this type of litigation, and one of the things that Congress has repeatedly failed to do is actually create a factual record. They haven't actually gone and looked at what are the different ways in which information is made available, what's the scope of information that's out there, what does speech look like, how do you look at information in this medium, what is the whole. And we ask some questions about, is it a single page or is it the entire website, is it a link, what does it mean to consider a work? In the traditional medium, we're pretty clear about what that entails. The bill that finally passed in October, in addition to the sections that were struck down, has two other sections, one of which requires all internet service providers to make available the user empowerment technologies, these filtering and blocking tools. It doesn't say the parents have to use them, but it says that the industry has to take the step of making them available. Because, as Bruce said, I think there are many people who believe there's a problem, and parents do have an interest in the society. I think we have an interest in ensuring that parents are able to protect their children from information that they don't find appropriate for their children. And I think most of us acknowledge that what we might find appropriate for our 17-year-old, we probably don't want our 6- or 8-year-old to have access to. And the information that we're concerned about may be commercial pornography, but it also may be hate speech. It may be racist information. It may be information that we just don't think they're quite ready to handle. And there are a number of filtering and blocking tools and other approaches to giving parents abilities to deal with content. And these range from green spaces that are put together by cooperative efforts, the educational community, libraries, schools, PTAs, in conjunction with kind of big players in the content community, so ranging from, you know, an AOL or a Disney or a Time Warner, to try to help to figure out how can we create safe spaces, how can we create kind of a toolbox so that when parents are concerned, they can readily put protections in front of their kids to make sure that their kids aren't coming into contact with information they find objectionable. The other section of the statute, which I think is important, is that Congress also required under the law that a commission be established, and it's called the COPPA Commission, the Child Online Protection Act Commission. And it's a commission of 16 private sector individuals and 3 members of government. And the task of the commission is actually between now and the end of October to look at the viability and effectiveness of a variety of techniques for protecting children from information that's harmful to minors. So filtering and blocking tools, the notion of zoning cyberspace from XXX domain, among other things. And I think that while reasonable people can probably disagree about whether or not the statute that is currently before the court will be upheld, I, like Anne, don't believe it stands a chance. I do think that there is a large segment of folks who want to figure out how to protect the First Amendment and protect children. And I think that the hope is that this commission will do some of the fact-finding that Congress to date has avoided doing. And I think that when there are reasonable people in the room and you actually look at the facts that a lot of the information we're concerned about comes from overseas, A lot of it's non-commercial. As we know, it does move about very quickly, and that parents have an interest in deciding what their children see when they can do it. And as a parent, your ability to determine what's appropriate for your kid may be very different than the standard that the government may set. And I think that there's a real interest in trying to figure out the factual record. And you know, my hope is that Congress will do a little bit much better job on the fact finding, because this process of statute followed by litigation doesn't actually get us to the problem at hand, which is how do we make sure that children have appropriate protections, and what it does do is cost everybody a lot of money in the process.
Thanks, TJ. We move now to Bruce Taylor. Bruce?
As you can imagine, I probably disagree with Ann Beeson on most things that involve law. She said that this case depends on the facts, and in one sense, she's right. She can only win if she makes the facts to appear to the court to be what they aren't. I think that we should have this statute upheld if we can get the courts to apply the law. Congress looked at the opinion that came out of the Supreme Court in 1997 in the CBA case and said, well, if the court says we can't deal with a lot of the other parts of the internet, Usenet, listservs, emails, and whatever, but they said maybe you can take CGI scripts and this commercial activity on the web, that might be an area that is at least ripe at this stage of technology for regulation in some way. And Congress looks at that and said, well, what about just the commercial sites and not the nonprofit sites, because the commercial sites take credit cards? And what if we limit it to pornography? And how are we going to do that? We can do it by using the legal terms that apply to pornography. So they made a definition of harmful to minors that said material is harmful to minors if it's either obscene, triggering the obscenity test from Miller, which usually means hardcore pornography, or it meets that three-prong test that we call obscenity for minors or harmful to minors. It stems from the New York statute upheld in the Ginsburg case in 1968. Both of those terms, obscenity and harmful to minors, apply to pornography. They don't apply to sexual discussions that aren't prurient, meaning it's, you know, intended to appeal to a lustful, lascivious kind of an interest in sex. They aren't and can't be applied to material that don't depict sexual activity in a patently offensive way. Mere nudity can't be obscene, much less harmful to minors, and the court has said so. You look at a test like obscenity or child pornography or harmful to minors and say, well, I don't know what that means. And you say, well, that's because you haven't read the court cases. The statute doesn't define obscene under federal code. The Supreme Court has defined obscenity. Maybe that's a tough job, but that's why they have lawyers, so that we can go back and look through all the court cases and say, well, this is what obscenity means, because the Supreme Court said in Miller there's a three-prong test, and then in 1977, they said, well, when you get to prong two, you also use the average person applying community standards to determine whether it depicts sex in a patently offensive way. And then in 1987, the court said, oh, but when you get to prong three on serious value, you don't use the average person, you use a reasonable man test. And therefore, it takes sometimes a lawyer to tell you what the law means, but the court has always operated under the assumption that the law is something that can be understood by people, even if they don't get all the legal terms. And you don't need a lawyer to know in every instance. It's just like, what's a reasonable speed? What's a reasonable man do at a coroner? What's a reasonable doctor do during an operation? You don't ask juries to be doctors to sit on medical malpractice cases, or to even have a driver's license to sit on a traffic accident case. And the question at a traffic accident litigation isn't, what would I have done as a juror at that intersection? Could I have made it? Would I have stopped? Would I have kept my car under control? It's what would a reasonable person have done? And you get 11 other people, men and women, sitting on a jury saying, what would a reasonable man or reasonable person do in this situation? That's a tough judgment. And it's not one you can look up in a book and say, well, there's got to be some way objectively to figure this out. And if there was, we wouldn't have standards in this country that have the basis for what's on this cup, which says the Bill of Rights, which is written in words that cannot be defined, because they're based upon human judgment and the human being's ability to put themselves last instead of first. We have a presumption of innocence in American law. We have a burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt as a prosecutor, and I've been a prosecutor for all my legal life, for 25 years. I can't define that to a jury, neither can a court. They can give a jury guidelines. Well, beyond a reasonable doubt means, and they go from those kinds of doubts that would prevent you from acting on it in the most important of your own personal affairs. What the heck does that mean? Well, everybody knows what that means. Each person differently may have a different idea of how it applies to themselves, but when you get 12 people in a jury box, the function of the American judicial system, it's the best one we've ever been able to define because it is a way to have human beings sit in judgment on other human beings judging human conduct that nobody in the courtroom saw happen except maybe a couple of witnesses we bring in one at a time and then shove out of here. But they're not the people who decide the case. And the CDA defined the type of material that commercial sites had to ask for a credit card before they show to the public in a way that's available to minors to be harmful to minors under the same three-prong test that defines pornography like you find when you go to a convenience store. Now, one of the good things about harmful to minors is it's the standard that everybody in this courtroom is familiar with, whether you've ever heard of the term before or not. I would imagine that everyone here has been to a convenience store someplace in America, or has been to a gas station, or some place where they sell video store maybe, or even a movie theater where they might have some racier movies, or R-rated, or X-rated movies, or a magazine rack where they have men's magazines like Playboy, Penthouse, Hustler, and they might have some other materials like Cosmopolitan, or the, you know, one of the gay rights magazines, or a sexual information magazine, or an AIDS pamphlet. And if you notice, in every place in America, nobody makes a mistake about what goes behind the counter. All of the Hustlers and Penthouses and Playboys go behind the counter. None of the gay magazines and the AIDS information goes behind the counter. It's all out front. You can go into a library any place in this country, you can go to a supermarket, and you can find sexual information that's not prurient, that's not pornographic, but it's still sexual. And it's out there where kids can see it, adults can see it, because it's not harmful to minors. It's the harmful to minors laws under state codes that provide that, you know, mandate that if you're selling magazines, the print medium, and it's available to the public, including minors, then you've got to display or sell the harmful matter to adults and make them ask for it or make them reach for it or make them get it from behind a counter. That's what COPPA intends to do. Now, if that's all COPPA did, like the opinion in the hypothetical that was used for the moot court, you'd get, like Ann Beeson said, if it was against Larry Flint and a site like Flint Hefner, she'd lose. It's my job, therefore, in my opinion, that COPPA is constitutional because that is what it does. That it doesn't apply to the clients in the ACLU versus Reno cases pending in Philadelphia. That COPPA doesn't and cannot be applied and should not be. I agree with Ann that it doesn't. If it did, it would be unconstitutional, and I think it doesn't. Not just because you ask the prosecutor, oh, trust me, I wouldn't prosecute for gay sites. It's because if I'm the prosecutor, I'm the biggest redneck, and I hate everybody. I don't like gay people. I don't like people in wheelchairs, especially people who are handicapped. I can't stand anybody who even has sex because I don't do it, and therefore nobody else should. If I was that kind of a prosecutor, I'd look at a statute and say, give me a law that I can lock up all those people that are having all this fun. I'd look at COPPA and I'd say, I can't do it. Why? Because I couldn't convince a judge, much less than 12 average people, to say under this law and under the guidelines that have come from the Supreme Court for 30 years, that a law in America would prevent and prohibit a prosecutor from applying COPPA's definition of harmful to minors to a sex information or even a sex entertainment site for handicapped people. If you showed that to a child and they watch people in a wheelchair having sexual activity in a way that only they could do, I mean, kids might go, you want to see the, you know, the wheelchair people have sex? That may be a titillation of types, but it's not a patently offensive representation of sex. I don't think we could get 12 people to, that's not what the law is intended to do. And there have been cases where courts have discussed on the hypothetical arguments that have been raised, like in the ACLU case, could a harmful to minor standard or an obscenity test be applied to that kind of material? And the courts have said no. The reason they have to use hypotheticals is because there haven't been any prosecutions. There are very few harmful to minors actual arrests in this country because the stores all comply with it. Theaters comply with it. Video stores comply with it. Nobody does that. They don't sell adult material to kids in the real world. So therefore, the sites on the internet that know who COPPA is aimed at all, you know, are the ones who violate it. All the porn sites that give their free teasers, you go to the front page of their site and they got like 8 pictures. They got one bestiality, one group sex, one gay sex for men, one gay sex for women. They got a group sex, they got a urination sex, they got a torture sex, they got a whatever. All COPPA says, if you're in regularly engaged in the business of selling porn, you're taking a credit card to sell somebody 2,000 pictures on the internet, on the World Wide Web site. You can take the credit card before you show them the 10 free teaser pictures. That's all COPPA does. Now, how do we make sure that's all COPA does? How do we make sure that it only applies to the pornography? Well, one of the ways you do that is you look at what Congress intends. The second way you do it is you ask the court to make sure that's all that happens. And Ann Beeson goes into court and she says, I've got all these people who are afraid, Your Honor. What the court should say isn't, well, the law must be unconstitutional to make all these people scared. What it should say, if he applies the law in Philadelphia, is I'm going to narrow the scope of the statute consistent with the First Amendment principles in the Supreme Court and other cases that have relied on the First Amendment to make these decisions in the past. And I'm going to announce today a decision that says this statute is limited to this kind of pornography, can't be applied to the kind of speech that's merely controversial, and therefore all of her clients get to go home in peace, just like Congress intended. That solves both problems. One, COPA then is still on the books to be used against the pornographers who Congress passed it for, so that they would have to take their credit card before they show their kids the teasers, and they can sell all the, you know, harmful matter to adults that they want to. But the kids aren't going to be able to click on, put White House into their that little line at the top of the AOL where it says, you know, give me a search term and go. And the kid types in White House, or he types in Bambi. Browsers assume that if you don't put something in front of the term that it means www, and it assumes that you mean .com, because those are the most prevalent. So unless you tell it you're going to the .gov, it's going to bring you to the .com. And the pornographers know this, and that's why kids can inadvertently get it. And if they went to the, you know, hotsex.com, they would see a picture that says either, you know, maybe they're girls scantily clad or something, or black marks over it to give you an idea of what you're going to see when you pay your money and go behind the curtain, but they wouldn't see the hardcore pictures. They wouldn't see the penetration on the front page. And if that's all COPA does, that's what it should do, and that's not unconstitutional. If it's read that way.
One more minute.
And that's why it is important to dispel the facts being overblown. The fear of the people may be reasonable. When in the ACLU or whoever tells the guy in the wheelchair, you could get your site shut down and go to jail because you've got sexual information. Or the gay site that says, you're talking about gay sex, that's offensive to a lot of people, you could go to jail. Whatever reason those people have a fear, it's not because of the law, and that has to be made clear to them, either because they would go to a lawyer who would say, nobody's ever going to prosecute you, and if they did, we'll get you off, because the court are going to say this, no problem, or you go to court like Ann did, and I hope what happens is that the judge strikes the law because he doesn't understand it or because he thinks it could be over-applied to protect the speech, but that he protects all of our rights by preventing it from being applied to protect the speech. He can narrow it. He has a duty to narrow it. He better narrow it. I think the Supreme Court will narrow it if he doesn't, but I think this is a different battle in the CDA because this is an easier one to say, Congress intended this to apply to pornography. They said so in their committee report. The test for harmful to minors has always been applied to pornography. There's no evidence that it's been applied to anything but pornography. Therefore, we're going to narrow it to pornography, and everybody who's not in the porn business, go home and do what you're doing, and leaving just the pornographer standing there with COPA hanging right in the middle of their nose, and that's the way it should be, and I think that's the fair fight I hope we see come out of it.
Thanks, Bruce. And lastly, Jonathan Zittrain. Jonathan?
Thank you.
I'm going to do what I can to pull things together from the very disparate viewpoints we've heard from, which has been fascinating. It's been great, actually, to listen so far. So, three major points. Point number one, which has to do with the problem that we've been discussing. I at least see and hear when the Bruces say, look, we have a problem. The problem is there's a lot more porn available in the world today than there used to be. And they add a footnote to that, available to kids. Now, I actually noticed that already that represents some concession in the boundaries of the arguments. You don't have people saying, at least not explicitly, there's a lot more porn out there, that's bad. We can't let people see that. We have to cut it back. There's an appreciation for a line drawn by the Supreme Court, for better or for worse, that says, unless it is obscene, and you can have an argument over that small amount of material that actually qualifies as that, for the material that we're talking about here, it's okay for adults to see it. We're not saying, even though there's a lot more of it, and therefore a lot more adults will see a lot more of it, we need to stop that in some way. You hear from this side of the table the argument about it's about protecting kids. And sure enough, there's actually a New Yorker-esque cartoon that I wish I had with me and could throw up on a screen or something, but it shows somebody, a kid getting, in frame one, kicked out of the porn shop because he's way too young, he's got a propeller beanie,
And then in frame two, you see him going up to the computer and logging on to alt.sex.stories and happily getting all the porn he needs. In a fact-specific realm, I think it's a pretty hard fact to fight against that more kids can see more porn at less cost, both transactionally, in terms of embarrassment, and even in terms of money, than they possibly could before the internet. Now, I think Anne, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but the way she describes it is the internet is more speech. It's more everything. So yeah, maybe it's more porn, but the whole point is, and the thing that I think she highlighted as being what animated a lot of the thinking in the Communications Decency Act case, was that the internet is the source of a lot more speech in general. People are talking to each other, and there are different kinds of authors of speech now, or additional kinds of authors, littler authors, people that have enough gumption to put up a website or author an email, compared to people who actually produce a manuscript, find a publisher, or have enough money for a vanity publisher, or can pay Dan Rather to recite it. It turns out there's a lot more speech in general, and there's some appreciation that that's a great thing, that that's actually some way of improving our polity and our society, thanks to the technology that just wasn't there beforehand, that the world is a richer place. So then, of course, you say, how do you sever, if you agree that the pornographic component, at least with respect to kids, is a problem, how do you sever that part of it out from the rest of the speech that you think is so good? And again, I see, as I discuss the sort of concession on this side of the table that we're just talking about kids so far, there's a sort of parallel concession I see on this side of the table, which is we're talking mostly about the people at the margins that we don't want to have squelched. The kinds of plaintiffs, if it's declaratory judgment, defendants, if it's criminal action, that Anne is most eager to be representing, both, I think, for instrumental reasons and because that's really what might get you up in the morning, are people that have the artistic sites, the educational sites, the sites that still might fall under the purview of a poorly drafted law or arguably any law drafted in this area, and that's part of what Bruce was just talking about, is how easy it could be to draft a law that properly separates the two. You don't hear as much eagerness to actually go up and defend Larry Flint for what he wants to do. You don't see, even if the ACLU believes that Ginsburg should be overturned, again, at least in this environment, you don't see them saying, come on, Supreme Court, this is your chance to wake up and say that Playboy deserves to be on the bottom rack right next to the comic books, sold to the kids, maybe buy one, get one free in convenience stores. So again, I see actually a closeness in the positions that may not otherwise be apparent. So the second point, and this has to do with the solutions that have been offered if we define the problem as too much porn available to kids. And again, I'm not saying we do agree that that's the problem, but I'm saying if we do define it as that. For this, I give a sort of caution, because we have a range of solutions that are suggested. And again, at least for the purposes of argument, when you're before the Supreme Court saying, no, no, strike down this law, you might concede the problem. I understand the government has a great interest in protecting kids and that it has some way in which it ought to do so. And then you say, okay, given that that's the case, here are some other ways you can protect kids that are less restrictive. And that's why you hear Deirdre and others talking about the filtering mechanisms, the user-based filtering that are available to help solve the problem. And my caution here is actually, as an empirical matter, saying, if what you're worried about is the camel's nose getting into the tent, you start trying to sever out just pornography and just the kids, and you inevitably end up filtering out a lot more than you mean to. I actually think there's a credible argument to be made that the so-called less restrictive alternatives, the leading example of which, again, is this user-based filtering, are actually more dangerous along these lines. User-based filtering, Deirdre pointed out one feature of it, which is it has horizontal portability. What do I mean by that? By horizontal portability, I mean it doesn't just necessarily have to apply to porn. You could filter out hate speech with it. You could filter out Christian speech with it. You could filter out whatever kind of category somebody might go to the trouble of defining and then go to the trouble of rating sites to see whether they fall within that category or not. Once you have the architecture, the engine for filtering out the content, then it's just a matter of applying it. And if what you want is the maximum amount of robust speech you can get, and maybe you're willing to concede some small exception for this kind of American sensibility that pornography should not be in the hands of kids, it may be best to craft whatever solution limits itself to pornography by its terms than a more general filtering solution intended for pornography, but by its terms able to be applied to all sorts of different areas. And sure enough, if you tune in Cyber Patrol or one of the filtering softwares, pornographic images are just one checkbox offered to the administrator of the program, the mom or the dad or the librarian. You can check an amazing array of boxes about what kind of speech you want to filter. Another problem with filtering is its so-called vertical portability. The way these engines get written, the intention, and of course I think the only extent to which somebody on this side of the table might be willing to see them employed, is by a parent acting in loco parentis, in place of herself, for the child. But once the engine is written, it's actually quite easy to vertically move it in the chain. And by that I mean you could imagine ISPs that just subscribe to the filter. And all of their customers then, all of the customers of CompuServe, might be treated to only those sites that CompuServe chooses to allow through the filter, with CompuServe checking the boxes to say what they will include and what they will exclude, with perhaps a category being sites critical of CompuServe. All right, check that box. And it won't even necessarily say as an error, sorry, you know, CompuServe is trying to govern what you see. You can imagine the error being 404, not found, or try again later. Or the error might even be, if you were being really crafty, a really slow connection. And then as you're surfing the web, you're like, is this slow because it's slow, or is this slow because I'm not supposed to be looking at it? So that is some problems that adhere when you get into a filtered world and start producing a solution so effective, it's a Swiss Army knife, that actually may have uses far beyond it. The classic Frankenstein story about this, then you might get if you go with, you know, kind of hold your nose again if you're on this side of the table, and go with one of the solutions here, which says, here they keep saying, we keep trimming it back, and the Supreme Court strikes it down, we trim it back again, come on, how narrow can we get it to make it work? And I have some sympathy for the idea that says, if in fact the law really just hit commercial pornographers, and if in fact all it did was prevent kids from getting to the stuff in a way that prevents kids from getting the stuff at a supermarket, you know, okay, we can deal with that, maybe. There's even a way, as age verification systems are improving, you could imagine adults getting adult IDs that do not identify them. It actually takes the vector of your age and separates it from your identity. And by that I mean you could tell a site, I am over 18, and the site can believe it. It is properly certified that you actually are over 18, but it still has no idea who you are. That's actually even more effective than when you hand the driver's license to the clerk, because the driver's license doesn't merely certify your age. There's your name and your address on it as well, including the class of the vehicle you're licensed to operate.
Jonathan, another minute or so.
Another minute or so. Wow. Okay. The only other problem that you might say with Bruce's approach is he said, look, it's easy. We have cases on this. And maybe you all haven't read them, or maybe the public at large hasn't read them, but, you know, whatever. They can call a lawyer and read it. That has some limitations to it, to me, obviously. First, because if the people speaking on the net are a much broader swath, they aren't just professional publishers, to the extent that the law might be construed to reach them, they're going to worry, and they're not going to know the niceties of a three-prong test versus a two-prong test. In the words of Broderick v. Oklahoma, the danger of the sword of Damocles is that it hangs, not that it drops. It's the possibility of prosecution. It's the phone call from the top investigator at the Attorney General's office at your house asking you if you run a website, thank you, that's all we wanted to know, that might make you take it down, not the actual filing of a case about you. In the last 15 seconds I presume I have, I'll just glance over my third point, which I welcome a question about later. And that is the idea that perhaps if you look at, not from the supply side, which I've actually just been saying may be the better alternative, but again on the demand side, access to the computer itself is access to an incredibly powerful, enriching, and yes, to some extent, precisely because it's powerful, dangerous instrumentality. Maybe the proper thing is to really watch, at least if they're eight-year-olds, whether the kids even get to the computer. If they get to the computer, maybe they get the computer junior, a completely different computer that has its own so-called kitty corral that limits what they can get to, much as the way you would license who can get behind the wheel of a car. That's one way to at least allow kids some access while not having to burden the adults so much to say where they are. And with that, I should yield the time I don't have.
And thanks all panel members. We do have some time reserved for questions, so if anyone does have some questions or comments, this is the moment. And I guess I would say, as the question is asked, again, I will direct it, if you don't direct it, to an individual member, and either I will repeat the question or if you would also, so it would be for tape purposes. Dave Douglas, I guess you're the director of the Institute. You have to go first.
Yeah, let me ask you
Right. Right. I actually have a pretty strong skepticism about non-governmental solutions as somehow less opprobrious if they're ending up trying to do the same thing as a government one, for the reason that if you imagine full information, you know what CompuServe is filtering and why, okay, then you can go take your business elsewhere. If you don't know, and as yet have no reason to assume that full information, again, you could see CompuServe just producing those errors that are borderline deceptive. You could see governments as well doing it. Getting back to, say, imagine China, Singapore. Pick your government of choice and imagine that they now have access to this architecture that lets them do it. It may not even let you know what you don't know. And that's why I have kind of the skepticism about it that I do. And figure that an adult ID, I agree, there's going to be some stigma to it of getting one today because the only reason you want one is for porn. If you imagine getting your new computer out of the box and the first question that asks you is, by the way, are you over or under 18, or you know, will any user of this computer be under 18, and you had a way of certifying, then it wouldn't be a stigma thing anymore. It would just automatically have your poster pre-18 age and be able to send it.
Let me ask Deidre Mulligan and then perhaps Bruce Watson to comment as well.
Yeah, if you listen carefully, and I think I probably should have emphasized this a little bit more strongly, that when I talk about technical tools, I talk about user empowerment tools. And there is a huge difference between government-imposed solutions, whether it's through a legislative approach or the enforced use of a technical tool. And so right now, for example, there's legislation up on the Hill that just had a hearing on the Senate side to require libraries and educational institutions to employ blocking and filtering tools. And we are very opposed to that type of approach because, you know, as Jonathan said, the ability to use these tools in a variety of places does pose a risk of them being used in lieu of a statute if somebody requires you to use them. I think that when parents use them, in the words of Vice President Gore, we call that parenting. And I think that the fact that they might have some more flexibility, that they may allow parents to actually provide protections, it may not just be about information that's quote-unquote harmful to minors, is okay, because parents do that in the real world, and this is an environment where there are a variety of different types of information, and you don't want parents to keep their kids off in there. And so I think that in order for those tools, though, to be real tools of user empowerment, there are a bunch of hurdles we have to get over. One is disclosure. Right now, a lot of the tools, if you purchase a filtering product, you have no idea whose values you're purchasing. And that's very, very important. You know, most of us, when we buy the New York Times or we buy the Washington Post or the Christian Science Monitor or whatever newspaper it is, we have some sense of whose lens we're looking at the world through. And when you're buying a filtering product, right now the disclosure is about what the criteria are, how they block things. You know, you don't know. And so, you know, that's at least one piece. The second piece is there's, even though they're private tools, I think there are some due process concerns. What happens if you get blocked by a site, blocked by a technical tool? And the filtering company said, we're only blocking out things that are harmful to minors if you check off this box. They don't actually use that word, but, you know, things that are lewd or indecent or whatever they might say. and you happen to be, you know, one of Ann's clients, or one of the plaintiffs, current plaintiffs. You're the disability sex site, and you don't want to be in that box. Right now, there's not necessarily a process to get yourself unblocked. And so there's a bunch of questions that I think have to be answered before these can really be tools of user empowerment. Equating them with a government law that censors speech, I think, though, is a far stretch, unless the government imposes them, which they haven't done. And I do want to address just the second point, that, you know, when we talk about user empowerment tools, we talk about filtering, there's also this... people then want to talk about, well, why don't we use IDs? And I think you can think about labeling content, or you can think about labeling people. And I think both of them pose some risks. And, you know, while the pending litigation over COPPA, COPPA says that although you collect this information to restrict people from who are entering your site, you can't, you know, disclose it for other purposes, et cetera. However, we do know that law enforcement will get access to that information. We know that information is vulnerable, and both security purposes and also because there aren't, you know, we're dealing with a global medium, and who's operating the site, whose laws are going to apply to access information that's collected by a site. I mean, there are a lot of ifs out there, and I think that when we're talking about First Amendment protected activity, I don't think we want to go down the road of monitoring what everybody reads. I mean, I think all we have to do is look at the recent Lewinsky Star, where Kenneth Starr went in and wanted to find out what Monica had been purchasing at a bookstore, to know that that might not be the direction we want to head in, because it does create a rather attractive fishing pool of data about people's activities.
Bruce Watson, any thoughts?
Yes. I guess I'd offer two or three thoughts. One is, when we compare a law like COPPA with filtering, I don't think we should presume that this is an or. Our view at Enough is Enough is that there's an and involved here. We think that parents do have responsibilities, and very important responsibilities, and we have educational programs for parents. We also think that the technology industry has responsibilities, and there are things that they started to do and more things they could do in codes of conduct. But we also think the pornographers have responsibilities as well, that they should be working within certain boundaries, not putting out material which is clearly illegal and not making it available to kids. So to us, it's a false choice to say, should the pornographer have the responsibility or should the parents have the responsibility? The reality to us is actually they both have responsibilities. Now, as we move from there to saying, okay, sometimes you reach the situation where the solution, where the cure is worse than the problem. The sort of scenario that Professor Zittrain was saying of what could happen with filters. I think there's an important distinction there between filters on the one hand and rating systems on the other hand. And at the time of the CDA debate, many of the CDA opponents were arguing strongly, and I've got a clipping file of newspaper editorials, how we don't need CDA because we have the PICS, P-I-C-S, protocol, which will allow all sites to rate themselves and the problem will go away. And it was the opponents of CDA who were pushing that argument forward. And almost before the CDA was overturned, they were actually backtracking fairly rapidly as they realized, hey, if we create a system where every single site has to rate itself as to what type of site it is, my goodness, are we setting up the mechanism for any kind of censorship? And they themselves realized that the problem, the solution that they were offering, could in fact create a bigger problem. In the case of that sort of rating system across all sites, I think there is a legitimate concern that the problem could be worse, sorry, the solution could be worse than the problem. Filtering, I would suggest, is somewhat different, though. And the sort of vertical process that was referred to, that already is happening. There are different ISPs who do offer different degrees of filtered services. And there are consumer choices available. You can go to one, and their standard package is they have ticked these boxes, that they are going to exclude pornography plus these three or four other boxes. There are some who say, we can exclude what you want from here, and there are some who say, we will exclude only pornography. That's the only issue we're concerned about. If you're concerned about others, go elsewhere. So there is this sort of market developing in what are sometimes called clean ISPs who are doing that pre-filtered service. Now, that worries me less from a sort of paranoia point of view, because I think that the market forces do work. When Cyber Patrol, for example, created a bit of a stir by filtering out the American Family Association, which is one of the organizations that is in favor of filtering, the word got around fairly quickly. And that tends to be what happens. When anomalies take place in the filtering, the word does tend to get around. Is there a consumer's guide you can go to just now for that? No, there's not. It's an infant industry. But as it develops, I have a lot of confidence in the market forces providing exactly the sort of information the consumers are looking for, that these people block all of these things, these people give you a choice, and these people only block this.
Thanks, Bruce. Let me shift gears for just a moment and direct this to Ann Beeson and Bruce Taylor. You both talked about the litigation perhaps more than the other panelists. And to those who are not expert in the area, it seemed to us, seemed to me, that you're really talking about two very different things. And you're saying this isn't just about the Larry Flints of the world. We really are talking about a whole other category of folks who could be seriously affected and are, and that's why the courts are striking this down. Bruce, on the other hand, you seem to be saying, no, that's not what this statute's about. This statute really is about pornography and obscene materials for minors. Who's right between you two? Can we hear a little bit more about that?
Yeah. We haven't said enough throughout this debate tonight that what we're talking about here is a criminal statute. We're not talking about like speakers out there on the web who might lose a little bit of their audience because this law happens to be there. We're talking about a law that says that if they make the wrong decision when looking at their content on their site, okay, they're going to go to jail, okay? To jail. They're going to go to jail and they're going to pay up to $150,000 a day in criminal and civil penalties per day of violation. Now pretend that you're Tom Riley and you're the CEO of Planet Out and you've got 100,000 web pages on your site, okay? And you've also got tens of thousands of messages. You have no idea what these people have said in their messages. You know, they could be talking about all sorts of stuff. I mean, there's all sorts of like pretty explicit information about homosexuality on your site. What are you going to do? You're going to self-censor is what you're going to do. You're going to be very worried that you might go to jail, and therefore you are going to err on the side of caution, and you're going to take anything that could remotely come close to the line off the site. You're going to read the very words of the law, and you're going to look at your speech, you know, and think about it. I mean, Tom, I'm sure, doesn't find his speech to be harmful to minors, right? But he's thinking, and here's a gay man that has himself experienced much censorship in his life, has himself experienced, you know, much harassment simply about speech, you know, because he is a gay man, not even sexually explicit speech. Just any speech that discusses gay issues has been targeted as offensive to many, many people. And he's going to say, you know what, I got to practically shut my site down or else I might go to jail. And it's real people like that have to make the decisions, right, that are going to make the decisions. You can't wait till you're prosecuted. You got to, like, from one day to the next, decide whether or not you might go to jail and make a decision based on that and based on the words in the statute. And, you know, again, that's why it is that kind of evidence and those kind of facts that make judge after judge say, wow, these are real people. They're here in front of me. They're telling the truth. They're going to self-censor. And therefore, adults are going to be inhibited from accessing speech that they're entitled to access.
Bruce, a response?
I do think that the law applies only to pornographers and not to the gay site. When the gay site is talking about gay rights, gay issues, gay politics, even gay sex, you can talk about sex all you want, whether you're gay or heterosexual or you're asexual or you're a monk or a Catholic nun, that doesn't do it. But I think that what Ian is saying, in a sense, is it sounds really good, but I think it's nonsense in two ways to get too bought into it. It's a good lawyer trick to talk to the media, although judges should know better, about how this has got, you know, you're going to go to jail for 2 years and pay $150,000 a day. State laws, if you get prosecuted under state harmful minors laws and it says up to $10,000 or up to $50,000, the state judge can give it all to you. First offense, I never saw you before, you maybe only broke the law an inch, but I'm going to give you the whole maximum fine. But under the federal system, there are federal sentencing guidelines that prohibit a judge from giving the maximum penalty. You look at how their ability to pay, and there's a scale, and you find out the first offense, the second offenses, and how many other characteristics of the crime are involved in the conviction. And even though you're convicted all 10 people of the same crime, you're going to get 10 different penalties depending on the individual conduct. So the first offense fines under COPA probably can't exceed for a site like I don't know how much money the gay site makes off a particular picture that they could be held to have made available to minors that was harmful to minors, but it's not going to be enough to trigger a fine of more than, you know, maybe $5,000 or $10,000 under the existing guidelines. And first offense in jail probably is going to be more like 6 months or home detention for 3 months. And so there isn't this ability to punish people up to the maximum that the statute allows. However, the other half of it is, it's no better for a gay site to say, well, I'm a gay site, I should be able to have porn on my site. If the guy in the wheelchair puts up the centerfold from Hustler, he should take a credit card for that too, just like Larry Flint does when Larry Flint does. But when the gay guy or the handicapped guy puts material that's germane to what their issue is of, and they're not putting it up there to be pornographic, then they don't have to do anything to it. So the whole, all the gay, you know, rooms that discuss sex, if they want to have a gay chat room that's going to get racy and that kids shouldn't be in, there's not going to be a stigma for adult gay men any more than there is for adult heterosexual men or adult handicapped men to say, I'll show you my adult ID so I can go into this room that I know there aren't going to be any kids listening to me. It's just like a guy, you know, an adult wanting to go to an adult movie or an NC-17 or an R-rated movie. And so what if they ask you how old you are? I mean, that doesn't bother me. If I'm a porn customer, and I'll give them my money to buy the porn, I'll give them my credit card. So it's not so much that the gay site should have the right to do whatever they want. The gay site doesn't have the right to distribute harmful matter to minors. What we're arguing about is what's harmful to minors. The regular, you know, the First Amendment principle that says you can't suppress material because of its ideas or its messages, that applies. And therefore, if you're talking about sex and you're not doing it in a way that offends the three prongs of the obscenity test for adults or the obscenity test for minors, it's not harmful to minors. It doesn't affect what you do under COPE. You don't have to do anything. However, that doesn't mean that a gay site or a handicapped site can go into the porn business. They can't. They can have a gay site that has all kinds of sex information for gays, and they don't have to do anything to any of their pages. But if they want to have a gay centerfold of the month, they take a credit card to see that one page, just like porn people have to do for their pages. And I think that if the law gets upheld, it's going to be because the court recognizes the scope of COPA only to be what Congress said when they said the harmful to minors test applies to materials that are clearly pornographic and inappropriate for minor children of the age groups to which it's directed, and it prevents the traditional harmful to minors test from being extended to entertainment, library, or news materials that merely contain nudity or sexual information, regardless of how controversial they may be from a political or sexual viewpoint. That's the intent of Congress expressed in the committee report. If that's what the court says about COPA, then we do both what I'm trying to do and what I hope Ann's trying to do, which is to make it so that those legitimate speakers about sex who are afraid but aren't pornographic and shouldn't be subject to the law aren't and don't have to be afraid anymore. And still do what I'm trying to do, which is to say, I don't think anybody else in this whole world should have to do anything to get on the web. Kids should be able to use the web as much as you or I do. This isn't for adults. To heck with adults. We can fend for ourselves. My kid has just as much right to use the web as your kid, and if I can't read, or if I'm a working mother, if I'm an immigrant that just got here last week and I don't speak English and my kid goes to school, if I'm stupid, lazy, drunk, I don't like computers, my kid has a right to use it just as much as some upper, you know, middle class educated, I went to college and my kids, I've got a Pentium and all this junk. The only way to equalize kids is to make it so that both sets of kids get to go on the web. And there shouldn't be anybody picking what they see. If the pornographers are the ones polluting the web, I think we ought to make those SOBs do something about it, and not everybody else try to filter and close libraries and segregate and pick and race themselves. You know, I think that's why COPA's going in the right direction. We just have to make sure that the rifle shot hits the bad guys and make sure that this doesn't become a shotgun that kills all the good people. So I think in some sense we're after the same objective, and it's just going to be an argument that if I win it over COPA, you know, meaning me or the people on our side in our argument, it's going to be because it does exactly what Ann Beeson says it should only do, or that it doesn't do what she says it couldn't do. That it only does what I say it does, which is to control pornographers' conduct, and it doesn't do what she says, which is to spill out onto other kinds of content. So I think there is that common ground. But it's going to be an interesting site to watch, I guess, if you agree.
Can I just make a comment? One of the things that was interesting is that during the hearing on the House side on COPA, there were a representative from the adult entertainment industry, commercial pornographers, who in effect said, a lot of us are using credit card or some other adult verification. You don't really need to put this law in place to catch us. And I know that there are those that aren't, but it is kind of interesting that if you look at least the one hearing that there was, folks are saying, if you're talking about us, we're trying to do this already, and so you must be talking about someone other than us. And I think that there, you know, is a lot of concern that this is not just aimed at commercial pornographers. But I just want to go back. You know, Bruce said this is about the standard, and I think, you know, the harmful to minors standard, yes, it's narrower than indecency, but I think that, you know, what the court said in CDA and what I think the real issue is not the standard but the means. And is this the least restrictive means to deal with harmful to minors material? And I think we've been saying, no, it's not the least restrictive, and it's also not going to be the most effective. I'm sure that folks are just as concerned about their kids getting access to information that they consider harmful to minors that is not at a .com website and that is at an international website, that is not going to be captured by the scope of the law. And I think, you know, there's a broad array of information that's out there that parents would find just as offensive.
Okay. That's certainly some questions.
Let's just make one comment about what you said about the hearing. There was a pornographer who said, yes, some of us are using credit cards and we don't show free teasers. What I heard him saying is, yeah, this law doesn't really bother me because I already take it. I don't show free teasers. I take a credit card. I think what bothered him was, if you pass this law, you'll make my competitors have to hide their teasers, and that would be good. That would level the playing field. I don't think what he was saying was, you don't mean us pornographers. You must be after the gay site. What he really said was, yeah, you're after some of us pornographers, but some of us aren't really doing the bad stuff. But he didn't say that there weren't 50,000 porno websites that don't have porn on it. That's what this law is directed at. If you read the committee report, that's what they say, and that's what Congress said. This law is aimed at the free teasers on the porn, commercial porn websites. There are 50,000 of them that don't take a credit card, and they found a witness who went to Congress and said, well, some of us do. So the law, we don't, you know, you don't need the law to get to us.
Questions? Now, Anne, why don't we start with you if you want to respond.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. What you mean, if somebody were prosecuted under COPA?
Right. Let's say COPA, you know, wasn't active. Let's say that someone was trying to.
Right. No, you have no recourse whatsoever, which is, again, why the chilling effect of the law is going to be so strong. In fact, just the opposite is true. This notion that you might get acquitted, ultimately, and that, oh, that makes everything okay. Well, excuse me, it doesn't make it okay. You know, you've just had to, like, defend yourself from a criminal prosecution. You may have had your, like, name smeared all over the headlines. Your whole business could be ruined. You could have spent a fortune trying to defend yourself because you couldn't afford a criminal defense lawyer. So even if you ultimately are acquitted, you know, there could be severe damages. And, no, you have absolutely no recourse if you're acquitted. Nothing. Period.
Jonathan, and then Bruce Watson, you want to get on that?
Just a brief comment that some forms of challenge, and this is, since it's a criminal statute, it's going to be the government chasing you, not a civil action for which Rule 11 or some equivalent would be easily gotten. The closest equivalent is the Equal Access to Justice Act, which for certain kinds of actions for certain kind of people allows at least their attorneys to get reimbursed for all their fees when they haven't been paid for the course of the lawsuit for the time they spent. But again, its exact application, I'm not sure what
and
it would be.
And it's pretty limited, at least for the moment.
I would just be interested if the Bruces would even be willing to have it be a civil penalty rather than a criminal one.
There actually are civil penalty provisions, and nobody knows what they mean in COPA. And that's actually another issue, is who could bring an action for civil penalties under COPA.
Yeah,
Bruce Watson, you want to try your hand?
Not much I can answer with the social.
Okay. So, other questions, comments? Sir?
Up until 6 months ago, I was one of the 5 years old and didn't have a credit card. My son today, 11 years old, got one an application in the mail, pre-approved, because of his allowance, I'm sure. Deidre, you want to respond?
Well, I mean, the credit card companies are not interested in becoming the adult ID. You know, that's not at all what they see their role as. There are other folks who put themselves out there as folks who issue adult IDs. Now, whether or not you would rely upon them, who figures out whether or not they're reputable, I mean, there are a lot of questions there. But the credit card companies aren't interested in that being a major role.
Anyone else on the panel want to get on that one? Anne and then Bruce?
Yeah, I was just going to make the point that, I mean, yeah, it's clear that it's not, it's definitely not a proxy for age in the real world. And that just goes again to the statute's ineffectiveness in protecting children. It's just another factor. I mean, Congress, I'm sure, understood that, yes, there were some minors that could get credit cards and just made the decision, oh, well, you know, the only, they knew that it was one of the few things that would work on the web at all, and so they just accepted that inadequacy along with many other inadequacies.
Well, and my response to that is none of that is true. The reason that Congress picked credit cards is because the Supreme Court already discussed the presumption that most people who have credit cards are going to be adults. Not all. We know that some parents give their kids cards, or I guess some kids could steal bad credit cards. But what it was an intended method of saying to the vendor, if you take a credit card, we're going to protect you, even if the person is a kid and stole a card or got a card given to him by his parents. That's not something that makes the site care whether or not the kid is a kid or the adult's an adult. So COPA doesn't ask you, and it doesn't care, and it doesn't put any requirement on you to care whether the person who comes to your site is an adult or a child. It has nothing to do with that. It says, don't make your porn available to minors. But if you do, we're going to give you complete immunity if you take a credit card.
No.
Not because it's going to have a kid in there or an adult behind the credit card, but either because the presumption was that most credit cards are by adults. The other ones are, if a parent gives a kid a card, the parent runs the risk that your kid's going to get treated like an adult. When you give the kid a credit card, he's going to go out and act like an adult with it, and people are going to be protected for selling adult things. Booze, cigarettes, porn on the web, or whatever. So an adult at least has a choice of allowing a kid to get a card, and that's why it's in there. And the reason why Congress picked it is because it was one of the methods that the FCC authorized for dial-a-porn companies to be protected. When the dial-a-porn law was before the Supreme Court made the statement that the use of these technical methods by the FCC, including credit cards and PIN numbers, would deter all but the most enterprising and disobedient juveniles, and therefore it would protect most kids. That's why they picked credit cards, and that's the legal kind of history behind it. But it's just one of those things where Congress says, yeah, you maybe can identify for age, but we'll protect the site that at least takes a credit card. And then it's up to the parents, not so much if kids have cards, but it protects the site if a kid steals a card or something and can't blame the site for that.
Time left for one quick question or a question with some quick answers.
I don't think John
Oh, that was a plant if I ever heard one. Jonathan, are you related to him?
Yeah.
Jonathan, why don't we make this the final word, so if you would.
Fair enough. The technology is going to be offering lots of different answers. Certainly part of my point was the ultimate answer may lie within it. Also, an answer that goes in a direction that no one expected may also lie within it. It's not sufficiently indeterminate that we just throw up our hands and say, well, let's do the best we can. We can actually map out some ways in which these answers can go awry. One answer I hadn't talked about was what I think may emerge as the primary means of parental control of what their kids do, which is there'll simply be a log
You'll come home and you'll see where Joey went on the computer that day, and it'll be hard for Joey to figure out where the log is, or for all you know, maybe the log is getting sent in real time over the net to the parent's computer at work, where Joey can't get rid of it, and you'll just see, you know, you have to take a scan and see if there are any bad sites there. Or even better, technologies are being developed today to keep people in the workplace from playing too much solitaire on their windows. You can actually push a button and just see whatever your home computer screen is seeing right now on your computer screen, wherever you may be. And that idea, that you could actually catch Joey red-handed with his hand in the cookie jar, could make it a very popular technology, and again, one whose other uses are manifold and somewhat frightening. So again, I guess my way of wrapping up would be to say, I like the idea of Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the speech. There's a really good reason why stuff that has to do with speech has all of these slippery characteristics that make it just so dangerous to legislate in this area. We accept from the Supreme Court, although it may be fair to question, that this one area, obscenity and then to some other extent, harmful to minors material, does not fall within the ambit of the First Amendment. But again, drawing those lines, I'm much more comfortable saying commercial, non-commercial, or are you an ISP merely conveying the information? And if so, you're off the hook. Don't even worry about what it says. That puts the plan at all person a little bit more at ease. Those are distinctions that maybe you can make, but as soon as you have to start judging content, it's just really dicey. And that's why it may be that having kids that are just a little bit more savvy, it's a world in which they're going to have to develop their critical skills sooner, because they're going to find websites that tell them far ahead of time that there is no Santa, and they'll find websites that tell them all sorts of other things, too, that they're going to have to learn to develop some independent faculties a little sooner, for better or for worse.
To all those folks out there, there is no site that will tell you that Santa doesn't exist. I think that was not true, John.
No commercial site, anyway.
On that happy note, I thank all of our panelists very, very much.